are going to get a house call from a cardiologist this hour, so get your questions ready on preventing and treating heart disease. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's good to have you with us on this Thursday, January 3rd. This is another in our series of programs on New Year's resolutions that we received during our recent open line on how we could help you achieve your goals. And one of your goals is to have a healthier heart. You've come to the right place. We will also talk with our guest about some recent news involving niacin in the treatment of heart disease. But we welcome your questions of all kinds related to your heart at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dr. Patrick McBride, Professor of Medicine and Family Medicine, Associate Dean of Students, and Associate Director of the Preventive Cardiology Program at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. Good morning and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Thanks very much for being with us. So tell us about niacin. I know that that you have had significant experience with niacin and have some even done some research with it. What exactly is niacin and how is it used in the treatment of heart disease?
Well, niacin is vitamin B3. It was actually discovered on the UW campus in 1934. It's been used since the 1960s for cholesterol and heart disease, and we actually think it still has a place. But what's happened in the recent studies, it was used in addition to very high dose statin treatment for cholesterol, and when patients were already treated with either statins and another combination of cholesterol medicine in addition to the statin treatment, it didn't seem to add very much when people were already treated very aggressively.
Yes. So my husband's on a statin, and he takes a separate pill for the niacin. Should he be taking both of them?
Well, we always say talk to your doctor first, mm-hmm. because there are definitely circumstances where we still use both. So we don't think it's time to completely get rid of niacin yet. Niacin's been shown in many studies to be effective. It's especially effective for people with a type of cholesterol called triglycerides, which is a separate kind of cholesterol from other types. Very effective for reducing triglycerides and raising the good cholesterol. So there are going to be people saying, well, it's time to throw it away and not take it. But there are definitely types of cholesterol problems where niacin is still going to be very effective.
Yeah, after this a study came out and this news story came out, I think it was a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic was predicting that the phones in the offices of cardiologists around the country were going to be ringing off the hook. Is your phone ringing off the hook?
Well, we've gotten a few calls. Actually, it's not been ringing off the hook, but the study hasn't been published yet, so we don't have all the facts. And it turns out that in this particular study, and this is what people should pay attention to, it wasn't niacin alone that was added. There was another medication used in addition to niacin that was used to block flushing, because niacin is a very interesting vitamin. The vitamin used in niacin has another effect, and the effect is actually to give people a hot flush. It's literally like hot flashes that women get from menopause. And in order to block that side effect, they used another medication. That medication actually causes a blockage of bleeding in the platelets, a type of blood cell. And that side effect from that medication may have been the reason that there were problems with this study.
So I thought there was a medication that they called Tradaptive, I think.
Right.
And it contained not only a statin and niacin, but an additional element that was supposed to block the side effect of niacin.
That's correct. A third medication. And there's a concern that the third medication may have been an additional problem. And so that's why the medication is being removed from the market in Europe.
Yeah, and it's only in Europe. It's not in this country,
that's
this particular trio of medications in
right.
one. So what is your takeaway from this right now? I mean, what should listeners remember?
Two things. One is more research is needed, and two, talk to your doctor before stopping any medication. One of our major public health problems is that people make changes on their medication on their own. They stop taking medications based on news. And it's so important that every medication decision is individual. They really need to talk to their own doctor before making any medication changes.
And you believe that niacin still has benefit?
I think niacin is important for certain individual patients. Its place in cholesterol treatment is really changing as a result of these studies. One thing that's come out of these studies is how important statins really are for treatment. We keep finding out more and more that statins are really powerful and really important in cholesterol treatment and heart disease prevention.
Mm-hmm. And are you among the camps that say everybody should be on a statin?
Not at all. Statins are medicines like everything else, and they have pros and cons. The pros clearly outweigh the cons for lots of people that are at risk, but there are many people at low risk that certainly do not need a statin. So they're really for people that have high cholesterol, and they're for people that have heart disease and blockages in arteries, but not for people at low risk.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dr. Patrick McBride. He is with the University of Wisconsin Medical School. He is the Associate Director of the Preventive Cardiology Program. And he's here to talk with you about a healthy heart. Do you have a New Year's resolution to have a healthier heart, to do things for a healthier heart? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are following up on this open line that we had on New Year's resolutions, and having a healthier lifestyle, obviously, is one of the most popular New Year's resolutions, so we're here to help you with that, and we welcome your calls. Let's go to Gary in West Dallas. Hello, Gary.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Hey, I have a question about the plaque in the arteries. I know that you can reduce cholesterol just by changing your diet. But once the plaque is in your artery, can you reduce it by diet, or does that require some sort of intervention or medicine?
That's a great question, Gary. You know, you can actually improve plaque by lifestyle change. It depends on how high your cholesterol levels are and how abnormal they are. There are a significant number of people that with significant lifestyle change, marked change in eating, and improvement in exercise and weight, change in diabetes that actually could reverse plaque by just lifestyle change. Many people need the help of medicine on top of that. So it really depends on the individual and what led to the plaque in the first place and how far the plaque is along. So that's a question that you sit down with your doctor, sometimes the help of a cardiologist. But many people can reverse plaque with lifestyle change alone.
Great news. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much, Gary. And some people, I don't mean to turn this back to my husband, but you know, he was athletic. He never smoked. He took really good care of himself, not overweight in the least. I think he got dealt a bad gene because he had pretty aggressive plaque going on.
That's correct. And those are the people that are going to need medication. You know, the medicines that we use for cholesterol, what people don't realize, most of them really come from natural sources. You know, the first three statins, for example, came from natural sources. They came from yeast. And so people that have been dealt a high cholesterol from genetics, we can treat these a number of different ways. And for those people, in order to prevent plaque from progressing in their arteries or to try to reverse it, they do need medical treatment, and medical treatment's very effective. You know, one of the reasons that I'm really enthusiastic about being in cardiology these days is that we can make such a difference with treatment. It's a very treatable problem, but people really have to work together with their healthcare team to try to reverse this problem, but it's very treatable.
So what's the single best thing we can do to promote a good, healthy heart?
I think exercise. I think it's really most important. For those that smoke, of course, that's the most important thing.
Quit smoking.
Stop that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And exercise, how much exercise do we need to do to have a healthy heart?
You know, 30 minutes a day would be a perfect prescription for most people.
you know, I've been reading about, hey, you do more strength training versus aerobic training versus this kind of training. What's your advice?
Well, you know, there's three elements to fitness, really. We talk about all of them being important. People really need strength because the tasks that we do every day, working in the yard, carrying salt in or dog food or groceries from the car, that sort of thing, all of them are important. So strength, flexibility, and endurance, they're all important. So a combined exercise program that includes aerobic activities, strength training, and stretching, all of those are important elements of fitness.
Yeah. What about all the stress that I'm under?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a really important piece. People always talk about stress, and you know, we do a lot of different things that are important elements to helping reducing stress as part of a healthy lifestyle. So programs that deal with stress, lots of different ways to deal with it, you know, meditation, mindfulness, yoga, tai chi, qigong, any ways that people, you know, spiritual programs, a lot of different ways to deal with stress. And I think it's a really important element of an overall healthy lifestyle.
Can I be overweight and still have a healthy heart?
You know, people can. It depends on the definition of overweight. You know, there's an interesting study people are going to read about today in the paper that says overweight people may live a little longer than normal weight people.
I saw that headline. Yeah,
yeah, and you know, it's the definition of overweight, I think. And the issue is, you know, sometimes I believe in moderation in all things. Because sometimes that weight can be muscle mass. You know, people that are stronger are a little bit heavier. I think sometimes a little bit of overweight, some people feel may protect them from times when they're stressed. Being underweight, being overly concerned about weight can be a health issue. So I think people need to be a bit more relaxed. I think people need to eat healthy. We all know that. But it's the type of foods we eat that are more important than sometimes our weight. Healthy eating, you know, overall of non-processed foods, a well-balanced amount of foods. So sometimes I think we worry too much. And I think people need to relax a little bit and use good common practical sense.
We are talking with Dr. Patrick McBride, a professor of medicine and family medicine, associate dean of students, and associate director of the preventive cardiology program at the UW Medical School. He's here to answer questions you have about heart health. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll be with us tomorrow at this time. It's our Week in Review. We'll have two guests of different political perspectives weighing in on the top news stories of the week, including the fiscal cliff deal, mining getting top priority in the state, and other news stories from the week. It's the Week in Review every Friday from 8 until 9. Right now, we are welcoming your questions about your heart for Dr. Patrick McBride, who is the Associate Director of the Preventive Cardiology Program at the UW Medical School. And Karen Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Karen.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling because I've been told I have low blood pressure, and I'm wondering what the possible downsides or negative effects of that would be.
Karen, do you have any problems with it, any symptoms?
No, I really haven't. Other than, you know, poor circulation, cold hands and feet.
Well, generally, having low blood pressure is a good thing. You know, as long as you don't feel bad, have dizziness, lightheadedness, or medical problems associated with it, low blood pressure is not generally associated with health issues. If it's associated with a medical condition, a heart problem, a central nervous system, brain kind of problem, or a hormone kind of problem, it can be an issue. But generally, if your blood pressure runs on the low side, that's generally a good thing.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very much.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You, Karen. So what is the low side? I mean, what is the what should we strive for, I guess? What's the average?
Well, less than 120 on the top number and less than 80 on the low number is what we consider ideal. Mm-hmm. And you know, when people have numbers that are below 100 and below 70, sometimes people don't feel great. But most of the time when it's below those numbers and people feel fine, that's actually good news. On the high end, if it's over 140 for the top number and over 90, that's when we're concerned.
Let's go next to John in Hazelhurst. Hello, John. Hi, John. Are you there? John. Oh, I'm sorry that we don't have John. So let's go to Dawn in Green Bay. Hello, Dawn.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wish I knew the technical name for this test, but what do you think about the calcium scans? Are they effective? How do you use the results? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So some people have scans of their heart, and they look for calcium in the blood vessels of the heart. It's one test to look at potential risk of the heart. It's used for people that are what doctors consider moderate risk. If somebody is assessed by their doctor and deemed to be at very low risk of heart disease, say they have very good blood pressure, cholesterol, sugar, all those sorts of things, they generally don't need that kind of test. If somebody already has heart disease, they generally don't need the test. But if somebody's in that range where there's a family history of heart disease or they have a number of risk factors for heart disease, sometimes your doctor will recommend that type of screening test called a calcium score. It can be useful in predicting the future risk of heart disease and help motivate somebody to address their risk factors or help your doctor decide whether or not you need medical treatment for a risk factor. So it can be a useful test. One caveat about it, though, it does involve, it's a CT scan, and it does involve radiation. So for women particularly, sometimes we use a different test, which is an ultrasound of the blood vessels of the neck, which doesn't involve radiation. So there are options to look for plaque in different ways that you might want to talk to your doctor about.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much, Don. Should everybody have at some point a stress test for your heart?
No, that's a really good question, because in the past, people used to think stress tests were kind of an annual thing, and a lot of business guys say, well, I want an annual stress test. They're not screening tests, so stress tests should be limited to those people that are having symptoms generally. So we use stress tests for people that are having chest pain to determine if it's really heart disease or not, or for some other indications, people having symptoms of heart disease. They're not used as a screening test to try to determine if people have heart disease or not, only in the case of people having symptoms.
Yeah. You know, back to my good old husband, he had an X-ray or something. He had a different medical test for some surgery, I think, that he had coming up on his knee. And if I'm not mistaken, that's how they discover that there's a lot of plaque in his heart. He wasn't exhibiting any symptoms at all.
Yeah, there's new types of CT scans, and there's a test called an MRI, you know, which is a magnetic test. There's new novel ways that people are able to look at coronary arteries, you know, the arteries of the heart, that are being developed and are advancing pretty quickly, that we're able to look at the heart's arteries. You know, one thing about the heart, it won't sit still for us. You know, it's constantly beating, which is a good thing. And but in order to try to capture a picture of the blood vessels of the heart, you know, which are responsible for the majority of deaths in America, so they're very important, but they're constantly moving. So in order to capture them, we have to come up with this new technology, and CT scans and MRI are the new ways to do that. And the technology is advancing quickly. So people have come up with ways like this calcium scan that Dawn mentioned and the scan that your husband had. And these are ways that we do that in people that are at moderate to high risk, that have some risk factors that suggest we might need to look further. There are these new advanced technologies. They're not inexpensive, so they're used selectively in people that are at higher risk.
Let's go next to Lynn in Evansville. Hello, Lynn.
Yes, hello, and thank you very much for taking my call. My question has to do with LDL. My sister is currently on statins, and she's experiencing side effects, i.e. leg pain. And more recently, I just became aware of the fact that the global LDL, which is the bad cholesterol, is one measure, but there are, I've become aware that there are subfractions, not all of which, as I understand it, are contributory to heart disease. So my question would be, Should she have tests run to determine what her LDL profile is to see if she could come off of statins?
Well, that's a really good question. So first of all, statins, you know, they're generally really safe, but about 3 to 5% or so of people do get problems with muscle aching, and that muscle aching can really be a problem. And so there are other alternatives to lower LDL, to bad cholesterol. So there are some other treatments people can do when they have that problem. So the question about the subfractions, most types of LDL still contribute to blockages in the blood vessels. So even though some are more harmful than others, they still all can be a problem. So the question is that even though some are worse than others, they're still not all good for you. But it is worth sitting down with somebody that's an expert in cholesterol to sit down and say, how much of a problem is it? And what's her overall risk? And how much does she have to reduce her LDL? Because there can be other alternatives in treatment for her. So I would suggest she sit down with somebody that has expertise in cholesterol to see what alternatives she has.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Lynn, for the call. So what sorts of things can we do regarding our diet to help lower our cholesterol or raise our good cholesterol?
Yeah, there's several things that people can do. There's some really interesting alternatives people can do before medicine. So first of all, saturated fat is still an issue. So if that's high in somebody's diet, and there's lots of sources, there's both animal sources, you know, there are certain meats that are high in saturated fat, and there's some dairy sources that are high in fat. So people can go to lower fat dairy sources because dairy products are important. And so we have people go to lower fat dairy sources. We have people try to remove saturated fat from some of their meat sources to use leaner meats. Wild game is lower in saturated fat, for example. Try to eliminate some of the vegetable sources. Use healthier oils like olive oil and canola oil for cooking and for their oils. And then there are things that people could add to their diet, actually, that lower LDL. For example, nuts as a snack lower LDL cholesterol. Fiber lowers LDL cholesterol, so oats and oat bran. There's a fiber people can add as a supplement, psyllium, which is a type of fiber people can add, lowers that. For example, soy. So people can use soy products, soy milk, tofu, soy nuts as a snack, for example, which come in a lot of different flavors. So there's a number of different additives, and there's a lot of good information at the American Heart Association website on this that people can look up at ways to lower cholesterol. I recommend that website. I recommend the CDC website or the NIH website. They're all really good sources, American Heart, CDC, or the NIH website.
Excellent. So what's the latest on whether I should eat a lot of salmon for the omega-3s or, for that matter, take a supplement?
Yeah, well, the fish oil controversy kind of continues to brew, and the bottom line on this is still the same, that omega-3s are still good for our health. Especially when they come from healthy fish sources. So when they come from especially wild fish sources, because wild fish eat plants that are rich in omega-3s, and the omega-3s are good for our health overall. We know that when they're eaten from wild sources, they're really good. The issue about taking supplements is a different issue. You know, when they're used for the right purposes and the right people, so for example, people that have had a heart attack, there's still pretty good information that they're good for us. And for people, for example, with very high triglycerides, they still are helpful in reducing triglycerides. Taken as a regular supplement for the average person, for no specific reason, there doesn't appear to be any specific health benefit without a particular disease process.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Dr. Patrick McBride. He is the Associate Director of the Preventive Cardiology Program at UW, at the UW Medical School. And we're talking about things we can do to have a healthier heart. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question about heart health, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Orville in Madison is with us now. Hi, Orville.
Hi, Joy.
What's
up?
Morning,
Dr. McBride. Thanks for coming on.
Yes.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
If a person has controlled high blood pressure, controlled blood pressure by medication, and a normal ejection fraction, but has a pounding, what is called a pounding arrhythmia, not tachycardia, not bradycardia, but just pounding of the heart. That doesn't seem to be, doctors can't find out what it is. Do you have any idea or any suggestions about this?
Well, you know, pounding of the heart oftentimes can be a sensation people feel from sometimes extra beats. It can be from caffeine or stimulants of the heart. It sometimes can be related to stress. And so things that are stressful, either stimulants or just stress-related things, a person can learn to do relaxation. So we oftentimes recommend relaxation strategies for that.
You need to do some yoga, Orville.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks very much. What is usually the cause of arrhythmia?
Arrhythmias are abnormalities in the wiring of the heart. I find it really fascinating that our heart has wires in it. They're not made of metal, mm-hmm. but they're made of tissue. So our heart is full of wires. And when there's an abnormality in the way that the electrical impulses go through those wires, that causes a rhythm abnormality. Our heart is supposed to be in a regular rhythm going through those wires. And sometimes the wires get crossed, you know, the electrical impulse goes down the wrong pathway or one gets blocked and we get extra beats. Or sometimes, as Orville asked, you know, why is it going too fast or too hard? And it's because those electrical impulses get stimulated. And it can happen from anxiety. It can happen from stress. It can happen from a stimulant like caffeine or from a medication. It can happen for lots of reasons. And so there's many, many reasons we get these extra beats or these abnormal impulses. And so you have to find out exactly what kind of extra beat it is and what's causing it. And then we address that problem based on what it is.
Yeah. So maybe in some cases, not a big cause for alarm, but I thought they could be pretty dangerous if you had arrhythmia. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. So we always say, you know, there are, you know, serious arrhythmias and there are not serious arrhythmias. And so sometimes it's as simple as, you know, learning relaxation strategies or cutting back on caffeine. And sometimes it can be quite serious. It can be life-threatening. So we have to know what kind it is to know how significant we have to address it.
Let's go to John in Hazelhurst now. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for letting me have a second chance.
Oh, I'm glad you called back, John. That's all right. What was your question?
My question is this. I had a heart attack about 4 or 5 years ago, and the doctor put me on Plavix. At the time, I also was taking omeprazole. And he, in addition to the Plavix, he told me to take 2 baby aspirin because the omeprazole cuts the efficacy of the Plavix, and that he figured that this would make up for it. But now I'm seeing advertised on TV that omeprazole shouldn't be taken with Plavix in those commercials. I was wondering, do I have to worry?
Well, it's a really good question, and this gets at a bigger question, John, which is interactions with medicine. So it's very important to go in and sit down with your doctor and say, you know, I'm hearing this, and in my particular case, do my medicines interact with each other? And do I have to worry? Sometimes the condition is serious enough. We're aware that a label might say, don't mix these two medicines, but we need to do it anyway because the condition is serious enough, but we're watching it really carefully. So we're aware that two medicines might increase slightly the risk of bleeding, but we have to do it. So it does increase the risk that there's more bleeding, but because a condition is serious, we might do it. So yes, your risk of bleeding is higher, but your doctor may need to be doing that, and he's aware of it. So you need to make sure that you sit down with him and ask him, is this the case for me? Should I continue on all of these medicines, or is there something that I can cut back? We really appreciate it when a patient is aware of something like that and comes in and asks us those questions, because sometimes medicines get prescribed by different people, and somebody's not aware that somebody else has prescribed something. And so we really want somebody to call us up and bring in those questions.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, John. Yeah, the best to you. So people who have had heart attacks or are treating heart disease, it seems, are often taking aspirin. What is the aspirin doing, the baby aspirin?
Well, these aspirin doses are really important because what they do is they thin the blood, as way some people look at it. But what they're really doing is they're blocking the stickiness of this thing called the platelet, which is a blood clotting cell in the blood. And it's really important. So here's a great example of a natural medicine. Came from a leaf of a plant discovered, you know, hundreds of years ago. And this little aspirin is saving lives. It reduces the risk of another heart attack by 25%. So aspirin still has a really important place in heart disease prevention.
Is the baby aspirin something that many can take just as a preventive thing?
Yeah, well, we use aspirin as a preventive in people that haven't had heart disease at the, again, at the suggestion of a doctor, because aspirin, like anything else, can have side effects. So people with bleeding or people with ulcers and people with other health issues like too high of a blood pressure shouldn't be taking it. But if a male is over 55 and a female is over 65, it may be useful for prevention, but somebody should ask their doctor first.
Yeah. Well, John said that he had suffered a heart attack. What exactly happened there?
Well, for a person that has a heart attack, nearly always what happens is they have a blockage in one of the blood vessels of their heart, and it cracks open. And exactly why it cracks open is still an area of great study, but it usually is due to some stressful event. So this blockage in their artery cracks open, and a blood clot forms on top of it, and it totally blocks off that blood vessel, causes part of the heart to die. So where that part of the heart's not getting blood, it's that part of the heart no longer functions, and it dies. And if that part of the heart that dies is a very large area, a person can have a massive heart attack. If it's small, they might survive the heart attack. So what aspirin does is it prevents those blood clots from forming inside that blood vessel. So it's very important. What cholesterol treatment does is try to prevent those blockages from forming in the first place. And so there are a lot of different things that people that are at risk for forming of having a heart attack can do. And there are people that have had heart attacks that can do to try to prevent future heart attacks. So that's what this whole heart disease prevention effort is all about.
Mm-hmm. And is it true that if I were suffering a heart attack, my symptoms might be different than a man?
Yeah, you know, the nerves that go to the heart aren't as sensitive as, for example, the nerves that go to our hand. You know, we have lots of nerves that go to our hand that are very sensitive, but we don't have real sensitive nerves that go to our heart. So when we get heart symptoms, they're very vague. They could be, you know, sweating and nausea and very vague symptoms. And so oftentimes when people are having a heart attack, they don't feel acute pain. They oftentimes feel like they're having a generalized illness. You know, they feel like they're having a bad flu, for example. So they feel some aching all over. They have nausea. They have sweating. And so it's very hard sometimes to know they're having a heart attack.
Well, we will take more questions for Dr. Patrick McBride in just a moment. He is a professor of medicine and family medicine at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. He is Associate Dean of Students and Associate Director of the Preventive Cardiology Program. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up later this morning, Larry Mueller is with you after 11 o'clock, and many New Year's resolutions include a vow to quit smoking. Larry will get the latest information on how and why to quit smoking, plus some resources to help. He'll be talking with Dr. Michael Fiore coming up after 11. Well, we're talking about having a healthier heart in 2013, talking with Dr. Patrick McBride from the University of Wisconsin Medical School. And as you mentioned earlier in the program, Dr. McBride, if you smoke, quitting smoking is an important thing to do if you want to have a healthier heart. What is it that the smoking does that hurts our heart?
Well, you know, in each puff of cigarettes, there are 4,000 chemicals, and a lot of them are really damaging to the blood vessels. You know, they decrease the oxygen that goes to the heart, and these chemicals are really hard on the arteries that go to the heart, and they cause these blockages to develop. So they injure our blood vessels, and they contribute to the blockages in a lot of different ways. Every time a person takes a puff of cigarette smoke, it causes our blood vessels to narrow down. We call it constrict. So people can have an acute heart attack just from, you know, being exposed to cigarettes. When they wire up somebody that has been smoking a long time and they put an EKG on them, they have them walk into a smoky room, for example, their blood vessels will narrow down and their EKG will change. So even just being exposed to a little bit of tobacco smoke is really hard on the heart.
Yeah, sounds like it. Dr. McBride has worked in preventive cardiology for more than 25 years and has significant experience with niacin, by the way. We talked earlier in the hour about a new study on niacin and medication that included niacin and some other substances. I did not know that niacin was discovered on the UW campus back in 1934 by Conrad Elvium. Madison is amazing. I actually discovered niacin here, as well as, I think, vitamin D and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Scott has a question about niacin. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a heart issue a number of years ago, and I've been doing a lot of research just trying to stay on top of the latest information. And regarding your niacin information, I read that the flush free niacin, the way the molecules are bound, prevents the niacin actually from doing what it's supposed to do to help your cholesterol. That's more or less what you said, correct?
That's correct. So yeah, flush-free niacin doesn't help cholesterol. It's a derivative of niacin.
Yeah. So the interesting thing is when I go to Walgreens to buy niacin, I take 2,000 milligrams a day and in addition to my aspirin. But when I go to Walgreens, every bottle of niacin on their shelf is flush-free.
Yep.
So I always have to go to the pharmacy counter and ask for their double top secret regular niacin that they keep in the bath.
They're double top secret ones, huh?
I'm really glad you brought that up, because what happens is, you know, since real niacin, vitamin B3, just plain niacin, causes some flushing for people, when you take regular niacin, and it usually only lasts for the first few days that you're on it, you take it and for about 3 or 4 minutes, after it's been absorbed, people get this short hot flash, just like a woman in menopause gets a hot flash. When people experiencing that, they go, well, this is uncomfortable. So the next time they go to a health food store, a pharmacy, they go, wow, here's this flush-free stuff. So I think I'll take that. Well, that's not actually niacin. It's called nicotinamide, and it doesn't lower triglycerides or cholesterol. So they buy that, and it doesn't work. So flush-free niacin is not really niacin. So I'm really glad you brought that up, Scott.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear you point that out, because I've talked to other people that have had heart issues, and I point that out to them. They're, well, yeah, but I don't like that flush, so I'm going to continue to get that. the other point I wanted to bring up is I'd also read a book by another cardiologist, and he talks about heart disease being an inflammatory disease,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes a result of something in your body that your body doesn't like and it's reacting to it. In particular, it might be gluten or sugar or combinations of things. What are your comments on that?
And, well, that's a really good question, because there's a lot of interesting research on that. And, you know, the things that lead to heart disease right now, so sugar, diabetes, blood pressure, cholesterol, different types of cholesterol, they're all actually inflammatory, so they irritate the artery. That's what inflammation means. So when we take in too many toxins, you know, too much food, and it floats around the body for too long, it becomes irritating. So some people are kind of looking for a magic ingredient. You know, what's the thing? So there's a test called C-reactive protein, or CRP. There's some other tests that people are pushing right now. Some of those, they're still under a lot of research right now. But when we overdo anything, like, for example, tobacco, or when we underdo activity, because exercise and weight loss reduce inflammation in our body, when we eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, it reduces inflammation. Omega-3s in fish, for example, reduce inflammation. Fiber, healthy foods reduce inflammation, lowering our blood sugar, lowering our blood pressure. lowering our cholesterol reduces inflammation. So basically all the things that we know that are good for us reduce inflammation. All the things that are bad for us increase it. Those improve heart disease.
Scott, thanks for the call. Is niacin, the over-the-counter niacin, whether it's the double top secret,
yeah.
do I want to just as a sort of a preventive thing, take a supplement of niacin from an over-the-counter, bottle?
Definitely not. I'm glad you asked that, because even though it's a vitamin, in its vitamin dose, which is, in a multivitamin, 30 milligrams, you wouldn't even notice you're on it. But if you took it as a treatment or preventive, it could have quite a bit of side effects. So even though it's vitamin B3, at the dose that would lower cholesterol or work for heart disease, it's a pretty high dose. It's a mega dose.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we use it as a treatment, we're using 1,000 milligrams like Scott or 2,000, and that's going to cause quite a bit of side effects for people's stomach side effects or some blood sugar issues or even gout for some people. So we have to be very careful with it at high doses. So it should only be taken at higher doses under the direction of a doctor, somebody who's familiar with it.
Sounds good. Matt in Neshkoro is with us now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Dr. McBride at interview day last month. But I had a question about monoclonal antibodies. I saw a phase 2 study that was targeting a ligand that recycled LDL receptors. And I was wondering if you were following this research and if you anticipate its release onto the market and if there are similar drugs that are close to the market.
Yes, that's a really good question. There's some really exciting cholesterol treatments that are right around the corner. We've been kind of waiting for some new cholesterol treatments for several years, so we're pretty excited about the opportunity for some new treatments that are right around the corner. And what they're doing is they're targeting ways that our body gets rid of cholesterol and blocking different targets of the ways that our body eliminates cholesterol. And some of these medicines are really probably between a year and 3 years away, and they look like they're going to be very safe and very effective. So I think we're close to some breakthroughs in cholesterol.
So Matt, what's interview day?
Oh, I applied to the med school at UW-Madison.
Oh, well, good. Well, do you know yet?
No, I think I'll find out in the next 2 weeks.
Well, good luck.
Good luck.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's take another call from Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One is, what is your opinion of the organization that goes around called Lifeline Screening? And the other is the efficacy of taking red yeast rice pills for lowering cholesterol.
First of all, what is a Lifeline? Is that where they give CAT scans in supermarket parking lots and stuff like that?
Well, not CAT scans. They test for carotid artery blockage and abdominal aneurysms and things like that.
Okay.
Well, we're mixed on Lifeline screening. So for some people, it can be really helpful. If a person is the right person to be screened, it can be useful. They do a very kind of rapid screening. Ultrasounds are very safe. And if you're the person that's supposed to be screened, it's useful. But they screen a lot of people that really aren't indicated for the screening. So I'm mixed because they don't really screen who should be screened a lot of times. So that's why I'm a little bit mixed. The tests are completely safe and they're very inexpensive. So
mm-hmm.
No harm done there. But a lot of people get screened who shouldn't.
What about red yeast?
Yeah, red rice yeast. The problem with it, it's not regulated at all. And it comes from overseas and the products are extremely mixed. So some of them are really not very effective. Some of them could be harmful. We're really not fans of it at all. They contain statins in very mixed and small amounts. So if a person really wants to lower cholesterol, really take a statin because they're really purified. They contain the ingredients that are in red rice yeast. They're a lot cheaper, so you can buy statins as generics for $4. And then you know exactly what you're getting and how much, and you're really taking the ingredient that's regulated and purified, not, variable and unregulated.
Patricia, thank you. Carol in Oconomowoc is with us now. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I was at a whole food seminar, and they were talking about purification and detoxification. and how it would be an internal cleansing of your body. And there's a company called Standard Process that has a purification program that's based on herbs and fibers. Like you mentioned, fiber is very good for lowering your cholesterol. And I was just wondering if you could comment on purification or cleansing and its impact on heart health.
So there's really been no studies that have linked purification and cleansing with heart health. You know, we do know that eating unprocessed foods and healthy foods and probably locally produced foods are really associated with heart health, but not the process of purification and cleansing. There's been no research linking that with improved heart health yet.
Would you say you're an advocate of the Mediterranean diet, which is more plants, less meat?
Absolutely. It's a really healthy eating plan for overall health. You know, that kind of plan, which is healthy oils, lots of fruits and vegetables, lean meats, fish. A Mediterranean plan is a really healthy eating plan. We advocate it a lot.
Yeah. What about some doctors, I think some doctors who are completely vegetarian and say cut out all those animal products and super, super, super low fat, and that's the best you can do for your heart?
Well, being vegetarian can be a very healthy eating plan. You know, there's lots of studies that show that people who follow vegetarian eating plans are associated with longevity and healthy life. It depends. You know, there are some people who eat vegetarian that eat very high fat, sort, you know, for example, we've seen lots of people like that too. But so you can be very healthy eating a vegetarian plan, but you can also be very healthy eating dietary intakes like a Mediterranean plan or a, you know, local organic eating plan. You know, I think it's the overall intake of a person that really makes a difference.
Yeah.
You know, healthy eating is healthy eating.
And how many eggs can I have a week?
Three to four egg yolks a week.
All right. Let's go next to Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Rod.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was just going to make a quick comment. Well, it's one of these old remedies that maybe you know, doctors maybe don't agree, but the vinegar, the apple cider vinegar. My neighbor, he had some heart issues, same thing, and his wife says take a tablespoon a day. If he couldn't drink it straight, mix it with a little water. And he started doing that. Well, when he went for his next checkup, he said the doctor says everything is improved. So I've heard this through the years, and it's good for other things. I had itchy feet, you know, and I soaked my feet in there, and it took that.
But you don't drink it after that, right?
We've heard lots of good things about it.
So what apple cider vinegar is I guess it's not going to hurt you if you want to.
No, it's acetic acid. We've heard some good claims, but there's not been specific research about it.
What about the glass of red wine?
Well, you know, there's been, you know, good research that said that people that drink moderately live longer and live healthier. And moderately is really 3 ounces of red wine a day. And it looks like 6 ounces of beer, you know, the similar. So teetotalers, you know, live a little less healthy, and people that drink heavily definitely don't live as long.
Mm-hmm.
So moderation in all things again.
Well, let me give you the last minute to kind of give us a pep talk with our New Year's resolution here to have a healthier heart. What should we do?
What I would say about New Year's resolutions is be specific and do take small steps. And the other thing I would really encourage is be social. And what I mean by that is, don't keep them to yourself, but encourage people in the family or friends to work along with you, because what we find is social support really makes a difference. So if you're joining a group or having somebody go along with you, so in other words, don't say, well, I'm going to stop smoking, lose weight, and start exercising, but be very specific. I'm going to cut this out every day, and I'm going to contract with a friend. And I'm going to make small steps. You know, I'm going to cut out soda, or I'm going to stop taking lattes every day. I'm going to be very specific, be small, and be social.
Thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
Dr. Patrick McBride, he is a professor of medicine and family medicine, associate dean of students, and associate director of the preventive cardiology program at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. Thanks to Bill Mertens for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for on-air production. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. Much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.